The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners, and welcome to the Sunday Space Show program. And I am your host and your moderator and who knows what else, David Livingston. And it's great to be here. We do have open lines today. So this means that it is really a show for you to call in and to talk about what is on your mind, you know, the topics that interest you the most. So we definitely want to hear from you. Right now, the toll-free number is offline. I will tell you when I'm going to open it up. And I have a couple of announcements to make, and then hopefully we'll get to it. And again, all science calls, all space calls, STEM, STEAM, budgetary, economic, space policy programming, all of that is welcome. What's on your mind. Love first-time callers and hope many of you who call today are first-time callers, but the old-timers are certainly welcome too. So let me run through the announcements and then let's get the show on the road, as they say. The toll-free number for those of you who do want to call, and again, I'll tell you when I've turned it on, is 1-866-687-7223. Please remember that there are no call screeners. Let the phone ring until I can answer it, and I'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. And the email address is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And then you can also post comments on the blog, which a few of you do. And you know how to do that. So I'll just say if you want to post comments on the blog and you don't know how to do it, please email me at drspace at thespaceshow.com. And I will send you some very quick instructions on how to do that. But the preferred way of communicating with us is 1-866-687-7223, our toll-free number. Since this is a open line show, it means I actually have two other phone lines that are available. So if we get a provocative caller and somebody wants to talk to that caller, if you email me, I will give you the phone number to dial so that I can patch you into the mix and you can talk to whoever is calling us on the open line show. So keep that in mind if you feel a really biting edge to, for whatever reason, talk with the caller on the toll-free line, which again is 1-866-687-7223. Remember to visit our newsletter, our website, thespaceshow.com. At the end of today's program, I'll post the website newsletter, and that will be current for the week, and it will have the latest on who's coming on board in future weeks, and we're booking into the near end of the second quarter right now. So again, you'll see that at the bottom part of the website newsletter. The email newsletter goes out tomorrow morning, Monday morning, 6 a.m. California time. If you want to be on that distribution list, make sure I have your email address, and I will be happy to include you on that list. Everything we do is archived. You can listen right off of our website or very rapidly download shows. Upper left menu of our website, again at thespaceshow.com, you'll see Listen Live. So that tells you how to listen to live shows, archived MP3 shows on our website, podcasting shows, and Alexa. Feel free to share that information. Also, under support, you'll see our Cafe Press store. For those of you interested in T-shirts, logo wear, things of that nature with the Space Show on it, if you have suggestions for that store, I'd like to hear from you, okay? So please do check it out. To me, the most important part of the website is the center right side of the website where we talk about supporting the Space Show. So remember, we are a 501c3 nonprofit with onegiantleapfoundation.org. As a 501c3 nonprofit, if you pay federal taxes, you get a tax deduction for your gift. In California, we're a public benefit corporation, so if you're paying California taxes, you get a tax break in California as well. Your contributions keep the Space Show going. Without your support, there would not be a Space Show program. So we really do thank you. I'm still behind in some thank you notes. I'm getting through them this weekend and through tomorrow morning, and then I'll be all caught up. So I appreciate those of you who have not heard from me from your gift. I do have it, and you will be getting your official thank you note acknowledgement before the end of the weekend or very early Monday morning California time. And we do have sponsors, and we have a new sponsor, although I don't have their advertising material yet, but the new sponsor is going to be the National Space Society. But we do have sponsors, and the sponsors get a banner ad across our homepage. They can change that banner ad when they want. And in addition, I read a short message to the listeners from that sponsor. And on shorter shows, 60 minutes or less, I simply acknowledge each of our sponsors so I don't dig into their talk time. So because this is a full-length, probably longer than full-length show, I do want to read our sponsor's message. So for the first segment of today, the Space Development Network says, would you like to see space settlement occur within your lifetime? The Space Development Network is an online organization that allows you, the advocate, to join together with others to advance the plan for space development. We need people with a wide variety of interest and skills. The network is free to join. Check it out at spacedevelopment.org. And the Space Foundation is a sponsor. And, boy, their symposium, the 34th Symposium, just around the corner. I can't believe it's almost actually here. This is the 34th one. It's in Colorado Springs, Colorado at the Broadmoor Hotel, April 16th through the 19th. Their one-stop for all website is spacesymposium.org. And this is where global leaders and decision makers meet, and you can meet the same people and talk to them. So it's a really great event. And then we also want to thank the Integrated Space Plan. This is the highly developed chart that shows the path to becoming a spacefaring race, and you can see how technologies and destinations build upon one another. Explore hundreds of individual elements in more detail at thespaceplan.com. They have discussions and regular updates and other interactive features at their website that you can check out. You can buy your own full-size color poster of the Space Plan. There's an academic version and a regular version, so check it out. And you can frame it. It's inspiring. It's great for your family members. So, again, all of this is at thespaceplan.com. So, again, today is open lines. The topics you want to talk about, they should be space-related, science-related, engineering-related, technical-related, STEM, STEAM, that type of thing. And we definitely want to hear from you. I do have a couple of suggested topics, which maybe some of you will want to talk about, and maybe some of you will not. I don't know. But there is a British company that has announced plans to launch two new space tugs, T-U-G-S, designed to attach to old commsats and give them a life-extending boost into orbit. The space drone tugs are built by a London company called Effective Space, but they can also double as a space weapon. And you can check that out. The Daily Beast had a big article about it. You may want to talk about space tugs doubling as a space weapon if you check out that that article. Let's see. What else is there? NASA got more money than they expected in the big omnibus spending bill. They got, I think, over $20 billion, and they restored some projects that were going to be canceled. You might want to talk about the NASA budget. Is it really good to give them this much more money? Will the money be used well? What do you think? You think it'll make a difference in terms of space settlement and commercial space and new space and some of the topics that we like to talk about? Some of you may want to talk about this incredible incentive pay plan that Mr. Musk got approved for himself at Tesla. So initially, this roughly $55 billion incentive plan appeared to not be accepted. Some of the news media services like Bloomberg and others were saying the board was going to reject it. Well, lo and behold, when all the votes came in the following day, the plan was approved, and Mr. Musk can certainly profit enormously if certain incentives are met. So you might want to check about this, and somebody might want to talk about it. I know Tesla's not space, but Mr. Musk is certainly space-related, and we talk about him on lots and lots of space show programs. So if any of you want to talk about this new deal with Tesla, we're all ears, okay? Listener Jeff in Tucson sent me a fascinating article, This has to do with warehousing satellite frequencies. And the article used OneWeb as an example, but it applies to what SpaceX is doing and what others are doing. And that is they have these huge constellations of satellites, thousands of them, and they commandeer approvals from the FCC for the frequencies. They don't ever launch these satellites, but they commandeer the frequencies, hold them, turn them into competitive marketplace tool devices, even use them to help drive up prices. There is an economist at a Connecticut university who has been studying satellite and frequency warehousing. That is what it's called. And he's going to be on the space show in the very near future to talk about this. I thought it was pretty interesting. But some of you may want to talk about what the commercial satellite industry is doing and what these companies with the large constellations are planning on doing when they apply for launch licenses for thousands and thousands of satellites. So the article is at something called theoutline.com. And I don't really know what the title of the article is. It's kind of weird. So it might be 1980. The number of satellites OneWeb now says it needs to establish global internet, or that could be a tagline. It's an interesting way they laid out their website. Or it could be the future. The price of the internet is the space race nobody knows about. That's probably the title of it. Spectrum warehousing lets corporations control the price of the internet in the developing world. So some of you may want to talk about that, and you can probably find the article. I think it's really interesting. Today, there is a new poll indicating that humans really want to go to Mars in the 2030s. And you can find this on the online news service The Hill, T-H-E-H-I-L-L. Let's get humans to Mars in the 2030s. I think that's the title of the article. So you may want to talk about that poll. Okay, then space.com is reporting also today that a leak in the Mars rover Curiosity's wet chemistry test finds organics. An unexpected leak of a chemical designed to tag complex organic molecules collected and sampled by NASA's Mars rover Curiosity appears to have serendipitously bapped. This is going to be one of those Sundays for David and his tongue-tied Oklahoma tongue. Done its job, okay? And it's an interesting article. Did it do its job? Did it find what everyone hopes it finds? Well, what most people hope it finds. You can read about it on space.com today. And it, again, it is Leak in Mars Rover Curiosity's Wet Chemistry Test Finds Organics. So you can check that out. Maybe some of you will want to chat about that, okay? And then there's a lot of other kinds of things going on. ULA is laying the foundation for developing an iconosphere in cislunar space. So you can, you know, find articles about that. One of the places where you'll find articles about that is the moonsociety.org/MMM, which is Moon Miners Manifesto, /302, which is the issue of it. And ULA is pushing forward to develop an economic base in cislunar space. So that's what I have in mind. And if you want to talk about that, you're welcome to. The phone line is available. You can give us a call, and I hope to hear from you. 1-866-687-7223. And hopefully we have a busy day with those telephones. So, and again, your topics are welcome. You know, a lot of you may not find my suggested topics that interesting. So whatever's on your mind, we want to hear from you, okay? So while we're waiting, because it takes maybe between 1 and 3 minutes for what I say here in the studio to go out on the airways, depending on what stream you're listening to, for people to get it. See, somebody's calling now, so that's how long it takes to get that voice into the stream. Good afternoon, caller. Welcome to Open Line. Who are you? Where are you? Thank you for calling.
Hi, David. It's Mike Listener here in New Hampshire.
Hi, stranger. How are you?
Hey, I'm good. I am up to my eyeballs in work, but I am good. How are you, sir?
It's elbows and alligators or something like that, right?
Yeah, pretty much. It's just been busy, you know, between projects going on and snowstorms after snowstorm after snowstorm. But, yeah, I thought I'd check in, say hello, and see how you guys are doing.
What do you know about space attorney Pamela Meredith?
Nothing.
Have you heard of her?
No, I haven't.
She has been recommended by several listeners that I get her on the show for her perspective, which they claim is very different from our friend who used to be with the FCC, Ruth Montgomery. And
Laura.
And I've been talking to my ex-wife today about my son, Michael. He's going to have pending surgery, so Ruth is on my mind. And I have invited her a couple of times by email to come on the show. It sounds like she'd be a pretty interesting lady. And she's at American University, and she has engaged Laura before. And I used your name and Laura's and a couple of others, Mark's and a couple of others. And, of course, I've never gotten an answer from her. So I was going to ask you if you knew her and maybe explain why I'm not getting an answer. I guess she doesn't want to be on the show. That's obvious. But several listeners have requested her. So,
no, I have not heard her. But again, that's not surprising because a lot of us are starting to come out of the woodwork, and you know, we're not as popular as the personal injury attorneys, but we're definitely starting to grow in numbers.
Oh, every time I turn around, I read about her, hear about her, see a news article quoting yet another space attorney that I've never heard of before. It's unbelievable. It's like the field has gone viral.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know what? Last time I called in on Open Lines was back in February, I think, and I told you about a Maine spaceport initiative going on up here.
Right.
I went to one. It was a 2-day workshop. I went to the first day workshop, and I don't know. They definitely have a big goal in mind, and they're excited about it, and they're going to start moving forward with it, I guess, and see what happens. It's You know, I really can't go into detail, and because right now everything is just so generalized, and it was just kind of a feel-good meeting type of thing. But you know what? It's interesting that they're even considering it. You know, because well, you know, basically Maine is a very large state, and there's a lot of very populated state in some respects. But they're really trying to, you know, bring a new industry to the state and kind of, you know, build on something like Houston, Texas. You know, Texas does. They have Houston and such. They're trying to bring some industry into the state, not just for, you know, capitalism, but for education as well. That sounds like, you know, the overall goal of the initiative.
But, you know, the weather's got to suck up there. I mean, I don't know for a fact. I've not ever been to Maine. But mm-hmm. And they're so far north, so I just wonder what at least the commercial, maybe even the government launch opportunities really are from Maine.
Well, it's a good place to launch. It's a good place to launch. The latitude of Maine is a good place to launch into polar orbit, and you can do it. You can. It's a very good position to launch into polar orbit. I mean, basically, they're not looking at putting in medium sized rockets. You know, like you know something like you know a Falcon or an Atlas or anything like that. They're just looking for small sat launchers, essentially. And depending on how it progresses and where they actually station the spaceport, they might attract other some companies in that do horizontal launch as well.
Well, I'm interested in seeing how it develops and where it goes. Do you know what city or town it would be near?
Well, that's the idea. The whole idea is to decentralize it. You'd have a spaceport would be one aspect of it. But there would also be what they want to call a mission control where basically, you know, missions would be coordinated from. For example, you know, Houston, mission control is located in Houston, Texas, but Cape Kennedy is located in Florida. But it's from mission control where they control the launches and such of these missions. And that's kind of the idea they're building on right now. But that was what I gathered from it anyway. Like I said, this is in extreme formative stages. I mean, they're just starting to form committees and such and start moving forward with it. I only spent one day there, but it was an interesting day. The weather cooperated. I got to see our friends Elise and Carl again. They were there on that one. And it was, like I said, I think depending on how they approach it, they may have a very good idea.
When SpaceX was doing Falcon 1 at Kwajalein, so this tells you how long ago that was, mm-hmm. Huntsville built a new mission control, and all of the Kwajalein launches for the military and what was going on out at Kwajalein, 10,000 miles away, were being controlled out of Huntsville.
Right. So, yeah, with technology nowadays and the telecommunications, the Internet, et cetera, I mean, you don't have to be right next to a launch pad to, you know, to control these.
Do it from an iPhone, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, pretty much. Uh-huh. I mean, you gotta have a launch crew there, you know, obviously to set
physically,
up
yeah.
And such, but otherwise, you don't have to really have most of your people right there. So it's, like I said, I thought it was an interesting idea that they're even considering it. Whether it's gonna pan out, I don't know. I mean, I think it's gonna be a 10 to 15 year plan personally.
What's, Elise and Carl up to? Do they have anything new on hypersonics or with their testing plan? Are you aware of anything?
I'm not aware of anything. You'd have to ask them.
And I see Russia's touting these hypersonic weapons, and I should get them back on the show to talk about. Maybe he can talk about that. I don't know if they're BS or for real, but I've read articles where our Air Force generals say we have no defense against them.
So. Well, I mean, I think a lot of Putin's speech was about, it was twofold. One, you know, I analyzed it, and what he's talking about is basically a variation of what was called fractional orbital bombardment, and that was basically where a warhead is put into an almost complete orbit, and then it falls out of that almost complete orbit onto the target. That's basically what he was touting in his little stump speech there. But, you know, people got to understand, Putin did that for two reasons. One, to make himself look strong to the West and not make himself look weak to his new Chinese allies. So there was a lot of reasons for him doing that, aside from touting weapon systems.
Well, I still want to get Elise and Carl back on the show.
So. I think that's a great idea, but you'll have to talk to them about that.
So if you guys are listening, email me. Let's set up a new show. Otherwise, I'll get a hold of you after the show. Kim in Mexico has a comment or a note for you.
Sure.
And says, for Michael Listener, Nova Scotia is also considering a spaceport.
Yep, and in fact, well, here's a little preview of my next issue of my briefing letter coming out on Friday. Is basically right now they are the company that's going to launch from their maritime launch services is basically applied. They're getting ready to submit their environmental impact report, and once that gets passed, then the next step will be getting the financing together, and things should start moving along on them. But the big thing is the environmental. One thing I would note about that meeting up in Portland, Maine, on the spaceport, there was a representative from the FAA commercial space office there, and she actually lives in Maine.
Interesting.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty interesting. We had a nice chat afterwards when we were waiting to have our cars brought to us, and very interesting.
I've got a show planned with someone coming up, and I forget who it is, so if they happen to be listening, I certainly apologize. And they live in Maine. I don't get too much activity from Maine. But occasionally I do, and it always stands out, and unfortunately I don't remember the person's name. But maybe Maine is going to be a much more active space state.
Well, I think nowadays, you know, we'll see what happens. I mean, we'll see what happens. I mean, I think there's a lot of things that could potentially happen in the next few years that's going to make Maine look a lot more attractive to the space industry and get them out of the backwoods mentality.
We'll see. I mean, I just my impression of Maine is really crappy weather and fairly far north. So maybe they'll change my impression.
Well, look at it this way: there used to be a major strategic air command base there that based B-52 bombers. There used to be back in the 50s and 60s. There used to be Nike missile batteries there as well. And there was even talk about stationing a ground-based missile defense base. In Maine, too, at one point.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, your newsletter is coming out Friday. I was going to ask you when the next...
Yeah, either Thursday or Friday. I'm scrambling right now to get it pulled together. I've been wicked busy with a lot of other things, and that's been a chore scraping it together over the past few months or so. But, yeah, it's coming out on Friday again, and you'll see what there's a lot of good. Let me tell you this: there's a lot of good stuff that's going to probably make your eyes bug out when it comes out. So I'm not going to say anything further on it, but you'll just have to wait till it comes out.
You want to do a full show about it? Are you ready to come back?
Hit me up with some some dates after, you know, later on, and I'll see what my schedule looks like.
We'll do.
Okay.
Thanks for your call, Michael.
Good talking to you, David.
Bye-bye. Bye. Listener Michael has cleared the line. He hasn't been on for a while, and I like his legal and policy updates from a legal perspective. I know some of you probably aren't as enamored with legal stuff and space law, but it's always been a big interest of mine. The toll-free number is available, and we'd like to hear from you. 1-866-687-7223. And the email address, if you would like to send us an email instead, is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, @thespaceshow.com. And, again, you can comment on the blog. And if you don't know how to do it, email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com, and I'll send you a quick set of instructions. Hi, caller. Welcome to the Open Lines program today. Who are you? Where are you? Thank you for calling.
Oh, this is John Fort Worth.
Okay.
I was noticing something he was mentioning, Mike Listener's mentioning there about the Russians. One thing that's kind of interesting and has sort of maybe space implications as well about it is, which all in the specific device they're touting, but they're talking about building a nuclear-powered cruise missile, basically.
Nuclear-powered.
Actually, both. But the key thing is, U.S. had a project back, I think, in the late 50s. I think it was ended right before 60 or so, called the Pluton, I think it was called. And it was basically a Pluto, whatever. It was a plan It was the idea of using a nuclear ramjet powered cruise missile, you know. And what that would imply, though, is if they're really have field tested one of these things, which allegedly I think they said they did do a test, that would mean that they're working on something that could be also relevant technology of nuclear thermal propulsion. And I've long had the idea that that in terms of international space efforts, Russia could be the one to develop nuclear thermal, because I think they don't have quite the EPA restrictions that we do, and they have a lot of land in Siberia, and it's kind of vacuous. It'd be a lot easier for them to develop and test it, whereas we would have all kind of lawsuits, restrictions, regulations, congressional hearings to trying to do that, you know, even if we wanted to, I think, you know. Not that our technology isn't probably better, but you know what I'm saying.
I ask this question to Anatoly Zak a year or two ago on one of the programs that he was on. He's been on many, so I don't remember which one.
Mm-hmm.
And he said it might not be so easy. He said, you know, the impression that people have is the one that you just gave. But he said they do have anti-nuke protesters. They do have environmental protesters in Russia. And they do have opposition. And people do demonstrate and do oppose things. So there might be bigger blowback than you think. But, of course, they don't have an independent Congress or something like that. But they might
have Vladimir, too. You know?
Yeah, they might get some people's blowback, but obviously if the government wants to do it, they'll go ahead and do it, and to hell with the people and the protests. But he said it might not be as slam dunk as you might think it would be.
Might not be, but the point is that they really did do the test I think claimed they made, that they actually flew a prototype. I mean, that's a lot more dangerous than flying a nuclear thermal rocket, because they're not about flying it in atmosphere.
You know, exactly, yeah.
And that in itself should be raising some eyebrows if they're actually, I mean, some of those things comes crashing down on somebody, you know. Even if it doesn't have a bomb on it, if it's just a test plane, it could be an issue, you know.
But by the way, speaking of coming down on somebody, isn't the Chinese space station due to come down Easter weekend? And they're not yet ready to predict the impact area, but they will be doing that in the next couple of days as the event gets closer. But aren't we coming up on crash day for the Chinese space station, as I recall the news from earlier in the week?
Is that, well, I haven't been following as close as you have, so if it's Easter weekend, that's getting pretty close.
I think it's, boy, somebody can correct me. I don't follow it that close, but I see the headlines coming in from Jeff Faust and from a couple of other people. And
yeah.
I think it's next weekend where they're thinking. And by the way, listeners, I forgot to mention, next Sunday is Easter, and there will not be a space show program that day. So I just want to clue you in. We have a Monday, Tuesday Hotel Mars and Friday program, but we will not have a Sunday Easter program. What else is on your mind?
Well, Alan, I've been reading a book by a guy named Victor Norgard called Morning Star Pass.
So that's the first one, right?
Yeah, that's the first one. You got to get started somewhere. It's a lengthy tome, actually.
Yeah, it's about 900 pages, as I recall. It's
this guy,
it's
this
a
guy
paperweight.
Really, yeah, case, but
it's a paperweight.
I've noticed a few things, though. That one thing I noticed, which was, for some reason, he misnamed the F-22 the Lightning. I noticed that.
Or did he purposely misname it for his science fiction use?
Because we're in an alternate universe, perhaps. Huh?
Yeah.
And I also would point out that the caliber of the AK-74 is 5.45, not 5.56, which is the U.S. caliber for our M-60 and M-4. But at any rate, I know it's little nitty things, but on the more fun side, I know some of the characters. One of his favorite ladies there is debating is a guy named William Glass as opposed to Philip Glass.
So you see a relationship there, right?
Yeah, I am seeing a relationship.
Well, John is not here. Victor is not here to say if he meant to imply Philip Glass or not. I don't know the answer to that. I've never asked him that. But, you know, you could post it on the blog, and when John sees things relevant to him on the blog, and I would call this to his attention, he usually replies, just ask Jim Fincannon. They're up to 55 or 60 messages now about Xenon 129 coming from nuclear explosions. And, you know, they may, if this continues, they may actually top the record, which was going after Robert the Inventor and Fincannon and a couple of other people on Airship to Orbit. That so far has the record of blog posts for the space show. I think that was well over 150 blog posts. But so this may, if Fincannon and Mark Europe and Matt in Germany and Brandenburg keep it up, they may get to something similar to Airship to Orbit.
Keep at it, huh? Well, I just looked at it. There's this other guy, Frisky or something like that, named there, who was a part of the Magi, or i.e. MJ-12, obviously.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there going, wasn't there a guy named Mansell who was allegedly, according to conspiracy theorists, mind you, not necessarily reality, and so I'm not, you know, impugning his reputation in reality, who allegedly also had intelligence connections. And I wonder if that's who he's referring for, the one that the other ladies panel is going to have to debate. I'm just having a little fun. I'm noticing all these interesting little relationships when I'm reading this thing. It kind of getting great chuckles out of some of it.
Well, post some comments on the blog, and I'll make sure Dr. B sees them, and he'll probably respond, and he will tell you if he had some of these people in mind. Or whether it's just by chance that you're being reminded of them.
Yeah, well, at least the two people I mentioned have passed away, so I guess they can't sue, but maybe their families could. I don't know. Anyway, I mean no offense to them at any rate. I just noticed the relationship.
Yeah,
I'm kind of laughing.
You probably do, but...
Yeah.
Did you read that paper from this professor in Queensland University in Australia about academic prejudice, but he's using the UFO subject for his thing, and it's peer-reviewed.
Yeah.
It's published in Astropolitics, and I thought it was really a good peer-reviewed article, and I've got the guy coming on the show in a couple of days, or in 2 weeks, I think, because I think his comments about academic bias and prejudice are spot on, and he does use the UFO stuff as an example, but to sort of kind of supplement that, there has been a lot in the news about really top quality Navy pilots and modern sensors that are used in our Air Defense Command to protect the United States from missiles and other incoming stuff, detecting these abnormal things. We're seeing them on TV, you know, like flying really low across the ocean, doing all sorts of things that no aircraft we know of can do, and stuff like that. And the Defense Department keeps saying we're not tracking it, we're not paying attention. I don't believe that for a minute. But
well,
this guy's paper in Astropolitics kind of ties in with this, and I'm just wondering. I'm not saying these strange moving objects are coming from outer space or time warps. I'm not making that case at all. But I would think if there are aerial vehicles that can do this and are being picked up by sensors that we didn't have 10 years ago that are used in our national security and defense, according to legitimate news services, not paranormal news services, then what the hell is going on?
Well, that is interesting. Yeah. Well, yeah, I did read the paper, first of all, since you asked that question. Very interesting line of thinking there. And, yeah, I've also seen there's another... I think that Fox Tucker Carlson had another show with another former assistant defense secretary, you know, the sub cabinet level people.
Uh-huh.
Who since left and talked. He was saying that basically that the quality of sensors, like I think especially some of the IR search and track stuff,
uh-huh,
is a lot more advanced than what we had in yesteryear when, you know, the 50s and 60s and 70s, days of old, so to speak, in it.
Yeah, and they're used for our defense systems.
Yeah, but I mean, in the old days, yeah, we had, you know, F-86 fighters back in the 50s chasing something around, but they didn't have the kind of sensors that we had back nowadays, which are very sophisticated and can track these things, apparently.
Yeah, they can tell whether they're at 10,000 feet or 12,000 feet. They can track the angle that they're flying at, the speed, how long it takes them to go from 40,000 feet to 2,000 feet above the ocean, all sorts of stuff that you never had before that you mm-hmm. could track because these sensors are so darn sophisticated. So what the heck is going on? Does one of our adversaries have this kind of technology? It would seem to me the Navy would not be tracking our own technology if it was our own experimental stuff. Maybe they would. I don't know.
Well, I think if an adversary had something that good, I don't know which adversary it would be, but I think we'd be knowing more about them. Let's put it that
way,
rather quick.
Yeah, but we might not be knowing it publicly.
Well, that's what I'm saying. They would probably be exerting some kind of influence. No, I don't think there's any earthly, known earthly civilization, i.e. Russia, China, et cetera, that could possibly be flying those things, because in almost all areas we're the most advanced, you know, I mean, or at least parity. And so I think these are anomalous phenomena, perhaps we should say.
Well, when you see the video by the F-18s of that object going across the surface of the ocean, really low down, and how fast it's tracking and what it's doing, what the hell can move like that?
I'm not
jumping to conclusions that E.T. is showing his face or time travelers. I mean, if you look at Occam's razor, there's probably a much simpler explanation than something that is on the order of a Brandenburg explanation. But
we'll say it's an anomalous phenomenon.
Yeah, and maybe it is. I was going to say maybe this guy who launched himself on his rocket out near Mojave today to 1,800 feet to see if the world is flat, maybe he's got new technology now. He made a successful launch and parachuted down and made it back alive. You know, the guy who wants to show and prove to himself that the Earth is a frisbee shaped and it's flat. You know who I'm talking about. He actually got his launch off.
It could be from Wakanda or whatever it was called in Black Panther. I mean, they had a very advanced technology.
Well, that's science fiction.
That's the whole. I just thought that was an interesting demonstration of the Dolan's breakaway civilization theory, which is one of the many, you know. But but back to reality here. What you can say about it, I think is very significant is that it isn't just the pilot seeing something.
It's the sensor seeing
something, and it's actually tracking it. It's locked onto it. And that seems to me to indicate you've really got, and also at the same time, the Aegis ship is tracking it with its radar. So you're really having three different phenomenologies tracking the same thing, and you have video of it. That's four.
Yeah, and the Aegis is what we use to help protect against incoming rockets and missiles, the same sensor. So you can't blow it off. I don't believe the public statements that the Defense Department is not interested in this. I really don't believe that for a minute.
That's been the policy since the Condon report.
No,
policy. But secretly, I think there is a project, I believe. Well, here's what I think could be happening on this. I think there is a secret project to keep the study and to keep this thing under wraps. What probably has happened is that some other elements, i.e. this group of senators and a group of people in the Pentagon who probably weren't cleared for said project, created their own secret project in parallel.
You mean the one that Harry Reid created and spent?
Right. In other words, let's say there's this long-going project, okay, it's going along, and it's not confirming or denying anything. It's doing its thing. It's very little isolated black world effort. But then somebody else creates another one separately.
Well, that's what Harry Reid says that he did, and that was exposed in the middle of last year, was the project that Harry Reid created for, what, $25 million or something in the Senate?
Right.
And
my theory is it may not be the one that was going back to the days of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, which may be the real project, if you will, the one that dealt with the Rendlesham Forest case and interrogated the security guards. And, the one that the two suits show up every time a pilot chases one and tells them that you're not to tell anybody about this subject, you know, that bunch. But that this is probably somebody else or operating independently from data they're getting out of the system, you know.
Well, except the Navy pilots are going public and talking about it, and they're showing the gun video and the sensor video.
Well, I saw one pilot talking about it.
That's
he's
what
retired.
I mean. They're,
he's talking.
They're talking about it, and they're showing the video. So
right, because they apparently have slipped. Also, remember, a lot of these are Navy people.
Right.
The hotbed of the cover-up is in the Air Force, if you remember. I honestly believe that this may be a wheels-within-wheels scenario where you have two different dark projects that aren't communicating with each other. They're operating independently.
John, we've gone enough into la-la land.
That's very possible. In the world of non-disclosed projects that they don't know what the other one's doing.
All right, but I'm gonna cut it off. I don't want to go down this crazy road.
You don't want to go down a crazy road.
No,
reality.
I do raise the issue because I just wonder what's going on. I think there is something there to it. I'm not claiming that these are flying saucers from the Pleiades or who the hell knows, Zeta Reticuli or any place else. I think that it could be terrestrial technology by some country or some group. And I do think the Defense Department tracks and knows about this. And while I understand they may not want this to be publicly held information in any level of detail, I wish it were. That's about all I can
wonder
say.
What other country this could be other than Wakanda. I mean, the rest of them I'm not sure about.
I don't know. Maybe we'll live long enough to hear it. But I think it is space related, not because of UFOs and ET, but because of this technology, and it's got some amazing properties, and I wonder if humans could be inside those items, and could they withstand the kind of maneuverability and technology that they're going through. It's interesting. Anyway, I don't want to keep talking about it because it'll piss off too many listeners, and I don't want to do that. And I also clearly don't want the show to take on the appearance that we're going into the paranormal and the wacky land.
Well, I don't think we did. I think we talked about very objective stuff that's mainstream media now.
Yeah, it's absolutely mainstream media. And
the only other scenario I could come up with is that somebody within the Defense Department's actually faking this.
I don't know, but
that would be a total reversal of their policy of denial, of course.
Had been smart enough when I saw the F-18 pilots interviewed and written down their names, and I don't know if it was told, they're no longer in the Navy, but it'd be fun to have them on a show. But I don't remember their names. Maybe I could find it and find out how to reach them.
Probably.
And
whether they would talk or not is
your guess is as good as mine.
Well, I'll get off and see who else calls.
But maybe it's going to end up in time being more interesting than talking about the Falcon Heavy. What do you think? Or the VFR?
You never know. Well, the BFR is going to be interesting to see how that comes along. That is a major project.
I want to see it launch, and more than that, I want to hear it launch. So I got to figure out a way to be as close to it as possible for viewing and audible as possible when and if the damn thing launches. It's going to be acoustically and visually probably something that you would pass on generation after generation. It's going to be so powerful.
Yeah.
All right.
I hope it isn't like the N1, at least. Okay.
Well, that didn't make it very far. Thanks, John.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Listeners, John is off the phone, and so whoever wants to try to get in next is certainly welcome, and we'll probably go to more mundane topics like a Falcon Heavy or a ULA Vulcan or the BFR paper rocket as it now stands today, or who knows what, maybe a Tesla in space. Anyway, the phone number is 1-866-687-7223. I think the phone is ringing. I'm looking to see if I saw the light go off. Yes, the light is. I don't have a ringer for this phone. It's all done by lights. So let's see who's calling us, listeners. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. And who are you? Where are you? And what's on your mind?
Hi, David. This is Doug from Southern California.
Okay.
Yeah. I got an email from Sean Moss. He's been on the show, has he?
I don't know if he has or not, but you know how many emails I get from that guy a week?
Oh,
I mean, they're not directed to me, personally. They're to various news groups or groups that I belong to. So I think I get Facebook email from Sean Moss. I don't know him, so I don't believe he's ever been on the show. But I did see what he was asking for help with the other day. Is that what you're going to refer to?
Yeah, this is about the concept of a Mars treaty. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, and does the Outer Space Treaty apply to Mars? And I chose not to bother to respond to that. But I did see one or two notes where people responded to him, but I didn't pay a whole lot of attention to that question. But you can tell listeners what it's about. I don't know who he is. Do you know who he is? I'm sorry to be ignorant about him. I'm not attempting to demean him in any way. I just am unfamiliar with him other than through the email newsletters.
So I don't know everything about him, but I do know that he's a very active space advocate. He has written a book about Mars. Quite forget. I actually have it on my bookshelf. I need to look at it. But he, I think he had a website, moonmars.com or something like this. So what in the email that he sent out, unfortunately, I think he needs to understand the concept of blinded carbon copy because he exposed a whole bunch of emails. But nonetheless, he was asking for just general input. I guess he's at the point. I don't know if he's writing another book or something, but he's at the point of looking at essentially, and this is an idea I've never really heard about, whether there needs to be a Mars treaty, so that his belief is that when people go to Mars, that they're going to need to own, to sustain it, they're going to have commercial activities, and he believes commercial activities require ownership of real property, of the land. And so he feels as though, so he's asking people, what's your thoughts about the Outer Space Treaty? What do you think about the Moon Treaty? And I responded just quickly, just to him. I said, well, Moon Treaty, bad, because it just, I think it's been stillborn. OST, Outer Space Treaty, I think that's good. It's stood the test of time. People use it. They find it useful. Even the natural opponents of the Outer Space Treaty, sort of maybe your anti-UN people or your Republican people, even they say, yeah, we can work within it and we shouldn't discard of it. I mean, that's my sense of what they've been saying. So that's a pretty good sign that it's a functioning treaty. So that was my response. And in a follow-up email between he and I sort of got a little more insight into what he's talking about. And so basically he's asking a question of, does there need to be, real property that people who go there can own? And normally in these sort of space law questions, I sort of shy away from them just because I find them sort of frustrating in that it seems like the same questions can come up year after year, and they don't seem to get settled, especially like with property. I think there's been some advance in commercial space for sure in just the most recent years, but other stuff, planetary protection, I also don't think that's going to get resolved until, we're forced to resolve it through people, making action. But as I really got to thinking about it, I thought, I think maybe Sean is onto something because this issue really could get pushed fairly quickly, and that is, as Elon makes progress on his BFR, I think these issues are going to become more relevant, more urgent, and need to be addressed. David, do you think that's a fair belief?
No, I don't think the progress that Elon makes on the BFR will have anything to do with it, but what may have something to do with it would be when and if he applies for a launch license and he is denied because of where he's going to go on Mars because of planetary protection, or he wants to actually get ready to take a flight with people to Mars if that day ever comes, and right now I'm still skeptical, but and they say, no, you can't go to the equator, but we're happy to let you land with people on the North Pole. And he decides to appeal or fight that kind of decision. And I think we're really a long ways away from that. I don't think he's going to be taking human flights to Mars anytime soon. And whether he would be taking some kind of hardware or demo flight to Mars that required what a lot of people thought the Tesla should have gone through, sterilization, for example, and he does not think it needs to go through sterilization, whether that would push an issue for planetary protection, I don't know. I don't know what would... I think the deep space mining industry has a better shot at pushing for changes with property rights, but they're pretty far out in the future, too, before they're ready to do that.
So, David, I think that Elon is hot to trot to get at least a suborbital hops going on the BFR, because I think what he's trying to do is, I think he's trying at the earliest possible time, I think he wants to get people thinking that the BFR is going to become a reality. And so having a full-size BFS, the spaceship, doing up and down the hops is going to make people, good chance will make them think, man, this looks like he's actually moving forward.
Yeah, but that's not going to push planetary protection or property rights issues. That's what I thought you were asking me about.
Well, yeah. What I would say is that I think seeing some real hardware doing, you know, in real development, I think it would increase the pressure to talk about, well, you know, is it really going to last even after he applies for an FAA launch?
Well, first of all, you don't know that it's going to be an FAA launch because all of this is up in the air. The administration wants to shift a lot of responsibilities to the Department of Commerce. They want to, what they call, is simplify all of this kind of process. So a lot of this is up in the air, and with the retirement of George Neld, and nobody knows who's replacing him or what the department's coverage and responsibilities and jurisdictions are going to be if they decide to streamline regulations and move things around. That process itself may be streamlined, and he may not have to do what he'd have to do today.
Well, but a launch permit is going to come from somebody.
Yeah, but so, he's not capable of going to Mars with his suborbital hops, so I don't pursue a launch license issue for doing suborbital hops, do you?
Well, no. Well, no, you still have to get FAA approval for...
Yeah, I mean, right. Here's something that I think could change. And remember when I was starting the show, if you heard the beginning, I mentioned this Space.com article where this Curiosity instrument, and this is the one, by the way, that Gil Levin has been talking about, has been silenced by NASA over the years. And why isn't it... you know, sharing information. Well, now apparently some of its information has leaked out or is being shared, and they're saying it is finding and reporting organics. And, of course, organics can come from different sources. But let's assume that they really said now there's a real good chance of organics or something on Mars. I suspect that would give really new enforcement and regulatory emphasis to planetary protection, and how that would apply to somebody wanting a launch license, your guess is as good as mine.
So, David, I really wasn't planning on talking about launch license so much. What it is Sean Moss, he addressed the issue of, like, property rights by suggesting that people need to own property, and you know, again, these historic analogies, which are always, you know, questionable. He's saying, well, in the past, there was a sovereign like a king who granted, the right of colonists to have colonies, you know, and so grant them. But the question is who really owns Mars? Who can grant the property rights? And so Sean Moss, says, well, perhaps there could be a Mars administration, perhaps of the UNOOSP. Hey, do you know what that is?
Yeah, that's the COPUS organization. It's in Vienna, Austria, for their outer space jurisdiction.
Okay. As I thought about that, I think that he's on the wrong track. I don't think that's going to fly, because I just don't see the United States agreeing to the United Nations being given the ownership of Martian property to dole out according to what, to how the UN believes that it should be done. I just think the Republicans in the United States are not going to go for that. So it got me to thinking about, well, what, I mean, what could work? Because if people are, you know, if the rocket is being advanced in development, I think that these issues are going to become more relevant. And so what could actually work out? My thought is really that it's the people themselves who give value to the land by their own presence. And it's the people themselves that are going to be governed. So I think the idea of self-governance is something that would be pretty natural, that the colonists would say, you know, maybe governance by somebody else for a period of time, but I think eventually they're going to have self-governance. And so, given all these factors, my thought is that there are two historic analogies that I think could somewhat apply, and that is the Northwest Ordinance identified pieces of, well, territories, basically, and actually set out means by which they could become their own states and enter the Union. And I think that there could be something like that Republicans could go along with. There may need to be an initial governance, a sort of foreign governance of some type. But I think a second historic analogy is the story of the pilgrims when they made the Mayflower Compact, because they were going to a piece of land in which, if my understanding is correct, that there was no governance established there. And so they signed this compact among the men on the ship, and so they agreed to regulate themselves, giving, I think, one man, one vote. And so I could imagine that the people going to the moon or Mars could basically agree to some sort of approach to ownership and governance that would work and would allow them to basically own the property that they're working on.
So they just toss out the Outer Space Treaty?
Well, no. The land would not be owned by Earth countries. They wouldn't be an Earth country they wouldn't be their own independent country for a while until they reach, like, the Northwest Ordinance. I think it was something like 60,000 before they could vote their independence. And I'm not a lawyer, but I think that if a new political entity, if a new country came into existence, that it wouldn't be bound to the Outer Space Treaty if they hadn't signed it yet.
Well, they may not be bound to it, but the rest of the nations are bound to it. So I don't know how that would work. I don't think they could go off and do their own thing. But I don't know. I guess going back to your original question to me was, I would disagree with you that a rocket in production would influence this process. I think if you actually put people on the moon as a settlement, or, you know, we're actually capable of getting people to Mars as a settlement, or something like that, you'd probably have a much bigger chance of impacting this. I think if deep space industry organizations were actually ready to begin the process of setting up, in situ utilization and mining and stuff like that, you'd have a much more powerful tool to influence today's regulatory environment on these issues. I just don't think making a rocket, even if it may be capable, is much of a stick. I mean, I just disagree with you, that's all.
What I'm saying is that I don't think the suborbital hops by themselves would do the trick, but I think the degree to which it gets closer to people launching, I think it's proportionate, meaning the closer you get to launching people, the more this issue becomes a real issue that people feel like they can't ignore anymore.
Well,
so you're right. The
maybe.
First hop is nothing, but after they're doing, you know, their human rating it, that's more significant because it's getting closer to the point in which we actually do need to know the answer to this.
Right, and I think your best chance for influence is when everybody's on board that this is going to happen, and you're getting ready to go through the process of, I need a permit, and I'm going to go to the equator of Mars, and you're not going to send me to the North Pole.
And
now, even though, you know, the rocket may be in the final stages of testing or this or that or the other, that's, you know, they've got so many days to respond. That's a big issue. You can appeal. I guess you can appeal. I don't know if you can or not. But I think that's going to be the point of biggest pressure that you can put on the regulatory environment for change.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, no.
And the really strong pressure is, I think, that the powers that be, whether in the United States or the United Nations, whatever, if they fail to make a decision, then it all sort of either hits the fan if Elon is ready to go and the only thing lacking is a launch license and the government can't figure out what to do at that point. You know, that seems like an incompetent government. They have plenty of time and then they can't make the final decision. Or that, you know, people are going and almost by default they would be setting the rules just by, what's the term? You know, facts on the ground, you know?
So you're thinking they may just dismiss the regulatory environment and go anyway?
No, I don't think Elon can do that. I think the United States would allow them to launch, but in terms of bringing this issue to a head, it would force it rather quickly. I mean, the closer they get, the stronger the pressure is.
Oh, yeah, I think if they're ready to go and they're applying for, let's assume the U.S. gives them a launch license and the European agencies and the U.N. raise holy hell. And they say, no, you're not doing this. But the U.S. has granted a launch line. So now you have regulatory authorities at each other's neck. I'd love to see that, but
well, in that case, the Europeans waited too long to address the issue, and that's why I think that they might see what direction this is heading, and they might say, you know what, we need to start actually making decisions here.
Well, too bad, yeah. Michael Listener didn't call in after your call, because I don't know legally how any of these scenarios would play out, but. I hope I'm around to see it because I think it'll be a very interesting and a fun time.
Oh, I agree. Well, David, thanks for letting me share my thoughts.
Always. Thank you, Doug. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Bye. Hi, listeners. We have the open line, the line open again, 1-866-687-7223. And it looks like I'm skipping the break, so I'm waiting to see if the phone's going to ring again. Let me thank our second segment sponsor, Orbital ATK, the global leader in aerospace and defense technology, and they are known as a partner you can count on for advanced, and we have a caller on hold, for advanced reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense. AIAA, which is the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, is the largest aerospace professional society, 30,000 individual members, 88 countries represented, 95 corporate members. They work every day on aerospace science, technology, all sorts of things to benefit not just the businesses and the government, but humanity. And check them out at AIAA.org. Attend some of their events. Great networking, too. And then Celestis is still the only provider of Memorial spaceflight services in the world. Remember, they have a very aggressive 2018 manifest, 5 flights. April is now just about on us, so there's going to be a suborbital flight in April from Up Aerospace in New Mexico. And there's going to be another orbital mission. This is the 7th one in mid-2018. That'll be this summer from the Cape. On a Falcon Heavy. This is a General Atomics OTB satellite that's going to be launched. The second lunar mission is fourth quarter of this year. This is the one in Mahia, New Zealand, with Moon Express and the Rocket Lab Electron. there's going to be another orbital mission, their eighth one, in the fourth quarter from Vandenberg using a Falcon 9. And then their first Voyager mission. And they said details would be forthcoming in March. I haven't gotten the details yet, but we'll get them pretty quickly. And that's fourth quarter of 2018. So for more information, check out Celestis.com. We do have a caller on hold. Hi, caller. Welcome to the Space Show Open Lines. Who are you? Where are you, please?
This is Marshall.
Hey there, Marshall. How you doing?
Yeah, just fine. In my continuing research of replacing the International Space Station, I came across a company called Made in Space that is using 3D printers.
Oh, they've been on the show.
Robots.
Yeah, they've been on the show. We've done multiple shows with them. You need to listen to our archives.
Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, gee, we could use that to not only build these humongous radio telescopes that would be in space, but also make space-based solar power. And listening to some of the other people in the previous week, they were talking about putting nuclear power on the moon and Mars and so on like that to get the colonies going. And I'm going, hey, space-based solar power could power any of these colonies, particularly if we can make them large enough to basically produce more power than a small nuclear power plant.
Well, I don't think a lot of people agree with you, but I'm not going to argue with you. It's an idea that goes into the mix.
Mm-hmm. And it also makes another use for a new equatorial low Earth orbit space station, which is where I think it should have been in the first place, to do something that does have, you know, some real money behind it, a business that really could make money.
Which is what?
Building solar power stations in space. Collect the power, beam it to the ground, beam it to the moon, beam it to Mars.
Well, Marshall, how are you going to fund all of your grand ideas, and what are those spreadsheets for potential risk and profit going to look like?
Well, I'm still trying to get that my own brain around that one, but it's kind of like you really have to look hard and deep to find projects that could actually pay for themselves, and the problem is, just as you say, there's a huge risk in it because I can't see any real profit in it until, you know, year five or six of the next space station.
Of the next generation. I thought you were going to say the next century. But
No. I want to live to see a colony on Mars, but if it's the next century, hey, we ain't going to make it, babe.
Well, you're still fairly young. You may live to see something like that on Mars.
Yeah. Anyway, that's my 2 cents for today.
Mark, you need to call us in with some economics behind your plans rather than just thinking that space solar power is it or better.
Oh, well.
What are some specifics? I mean, why is it better than nuclear? I mean, it's a low-density form of energy. Help us to grasp it with some real facts and technical data.
Mm-hmm.
You're a technical guy. You can do that.
Yeah. First of all, if you're going to go with space-based solar power, the 3D printing is very logical because you can literally stack up the solar cells themselves, the little solar cells. You can stack those up as squares in a nice square box, which makes it easy to launch. And the material that you, the plastics that you make the 3D printing with, that ends up being sent up in just big tubs. And, you know, the curing agent, once again, big tubs, so it packs well. One of the biggest problems with solar panels that we have on, like, the International Space Station is they are extremely hard to pack up and then, what do they call that, extending the wings out?
Deploy. They deploy them.
Deploy them. Deploying the wings, they spend years trying to figure out, can they deploy it with, you know, little wires and pulleys and so on like that, which basically doesn't work too well. Now, I think Elon on the Dragon has gone about as far out as he can go with deploying the ones on the Dragon. So, you know, the smaller they are, the better. And let's face it, over the last 20 years, the solar panels have gotten so much better, so much more power. The amount of power they get per, I guess, gigaphotons that hit the panels keeps going up and up. And they also come really, really cheap. And I think that's where it's going. But I can't predict a lot of things because we're talking about technology that's 5 years out. And in that time, it may be that we can get a 45% efficient solar panel. And if you got current is about 20. So if you can go from a 20% efficiency to a 45% efficiency and make it so cheap that it's equivalent to, you know, your house power there in California, which is probably about 12 cents a kilowatt hour, you know, that's going to make a big difference in the size of the space, you know, space-based solar power system. And, you know, how you set it up and so on makes the engineering extremely hard because you've got to guess what's going to be out there 5 years in the future. That's tough.
Well, you have your work cut out for you, Marshall.
Yeah, and I have to do it on part-time for fun.
Well, at least you can do it.
Yeah, well, I guess that is a blessing in disguise, one of those Jewish things. May your children be smarter than you.
I think that's universal.
It probably is.
All right. That it?
Yeah, thank you. Bye.
As always, thank you. Bye-bye. Listeners, we're back to telling you that the line is available, and it is 1-866-687-7223. Emails have been shy today. I guess when the phone rings, there's fewer emails. But if you want to email us, it is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. Some interesting shows this week that I'll tell you about to see if we get some more phone calls here. So tomorrow, Mark Raymond is with us, and he runs the Dawn mission, as many of you will recall. And there's a lot of new information on Dawn and Ceres. And he has a Dawn journal, and I put the links to the Dawn journal in the newsletters and on the website newsletter when I publish that. And it's on the blog, I think, as well, so you can find it. So you might want to read his Dawn journal, but Mark is with us. Kim is with us with some updates and really interesting animations and visuals for Moonwards. And she has posted the links to videos and this information on the blog page for her show Tuesday night. So you can check that out. Hopefully you will check it out prior to the program with her on Tuesday. We have a caller. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, Doctor. This is David in Seattle.
Okay.
I'm responding to Marshall and his discussion of suggestion of using 3D printing to make solar cells for electric generation in orbit.
Okay.
I hate to rain on his parade, but 3D printing is great for rapid prototyping. People don't use it for large mass production of commodity items. It's too slow and it's too expensive. And if he wants to get a ton of solar cells in space, it's not the packaging and the weight that will be the issues eventually, because Elon Musk and his BFR or whoever else in their large rockets will take care of the packaging and the weight problems. It's the per unit manufacturing cost of the solar cell, and that's going to be done in large factories producing billions of solar cells very quickly at a very low cost. And that's not 3D printing.
So you're raining on his parade.
Well, I'm trying to be gentle.
That's because you come from Seattle and you live with so much rain, you don't know any other way, right?
There you go.
Well, I wish Marshall was still on the line to reply to you, but he's off the phone. But I'm not a big fan of solar power, and further out you go, the more difficulty you have in using it for the kinds of power you need. What would be interesting is if these NASA kilopower nuke generators that they're doing research on come to fruition, and I am trying to get the author of the paper on the show. He did kick it into NASA PR, which is typically the kiss of death, but we'll see what happens, and hopefully I can get him on the show and we can follow it up and book a date. But that would be an enormous power boost for a lot of projects. But we'll see how things progress and what people create and, you know, what they do. I think we're going to see a lot of changes in what we understand to be solar power and other kinds of power in the coming years.
To follow up on Dr. Doug and your discussion of people on Mars and the Outer Space Treaty, I kind of missed the beginning of that. But my guess is the U.S. UN continues to shrink in its relevancy as it becomes more and more a failed institution. And I imagine the kind of people that will actually have the cojones to go settle on Mars won't be taking orders from any bureaucracy back on Earth.
Well, I guess I hope I'm around to find out. That's about all I can say. I think you may be right, but that's pretty far off into the future. So, I don't know. Maybe the first groups of people that go to Mars will still be heavily Earth dependent and influenced by Earth dependent. I think it would take quite a number of years and a lot of experience to become more and more independent on Mars.
Yes, but when they do, they won't be told what to do.
Probably, but when will that, you know, could be 100 years of being on Mars. I don't know what it might be, what it would look like.
Last suggestion for a new topic, and this is a little off the wall, but it has to do with Mars. You remember Richard Hoagland's hyperdimensional physics.
How can I ever forget it? Yes.
I would appreciate it if one of our listeners with a lot better physics background than I, which is frankly none, could explain to me whether it makes sense or not, or whether it's hooey or whether he's on to something.
Good luck. So I don't know if anybody other than Richard can explain it. And I haven't talked to Richard in a long, long time, and I've not been on his show in a long, long time. Oh, Midnight in the Desert or something, Midnight in the Oasis or something like that. And when he has talked about explaining it, it's really, really hard to follow. And I don't know. I used to ask physicists about it that were on the show. And, you know, some things about hyperdimensional physics are real about, you know, the equilateral triangle and the points and things of that nature and what they mean. But I'm clearly not capable of explaining it or even fully understanding it. Am I skeptical? Yeah, of course. I don't know anyone who would talk about it, who would really understand it and who would have any credibility in their talking about it. David, I honestly don't know who I would turn to have that discussion.
Well, maybe John at Fort Worth would volunteer.
I don't know that he knows anything about it. He's I don't know if he's gone down the Richard Hoagland world, you know, or not. There is someone who might know something about it, but I doubt that he would talk about it, and that's Dr. Jurist. So he might have the basis down of what Richard talks about with hyperdimensional physics. But, you know, I, as I said, I haven't listened to a show in years, and I haven't been a guest on his show for a couple of years, and I haven't been to his website in a long time. But I haven't seen him discuss hyperdimensional physics since the days he was on the Art Bell show. So that was an unexpected topic and call. I haven't thought about Richard in a long, long time, and you know, I wish him well, and I just can't. It's just not something for the space show. Terry sent in a note. Have you had Bob Bigelow on your show? I'm not much on Cislunar, but if you have, why not the big B-30 and some living in space? Bob was on the show only one time. I met him again at an AIAA conference a couple of years ago in Pasadena, and he did not want to come on the show. I don't have his contact information other than Bigelow Aerospace in general. And whether I could get him back on the show or not, I don't know the answer to that. If I see him at another AIAA or other meeting, I would definitely ask him again. But he's only been on once, and I'd love to have him on again. So let's see. I have another caller. I have another caller on the line. Hi, caller. Who are you? Where are you, please?
Richard Easton from Dallas.
Hi, Richard. What's up on your mind?
Oh, just wanted to briefly talk about the Vanguard 60th. Celebration that they had in Washington on the 14th, and we had two people from the Air and Space Museum, Dave Dvorkin, and I'm sure you know Michael Neufeld. There were six Vanguardians there, which six people who'd worked on the original program, which of course the 60th isn't as big as the 50th. And didn't you go to the 50th anniversary of Explorer 1?
No.
No.
I've not been to any of those.
But I think most of Unbrown's people are gone now. But it was interesting and meeting people like John Hagen, who was the head of Project Vanguard. Two of his grandchildren were there. And Neufeld was talking about why Naval Research Lab won and von Braun lost. So it's amazing, you know, you look at the SpaceX people, how young they are today, and go back 60 years. And, you know, there are a lot of people in their 20s and 30s working on Project Vanguard, six of them were well enough to make it. I talked to a couple of them who were very, very alert. So it was an interesting experience.
Well, where was it held? In D.C.?
It was at the Naval Research Lab in D.C. And same conference room where they had the 50th anniversary 10 years ago that my dad talked at about 6 months before he was on the space show.
How many people were there?
I would say probably about 90, 100.
That's a good
bigger
turnout.
Celebration 10 years ago when every seat was taken in the conference room, which seats about 190. And I was talking afterwards with a couple of people, veterans. One guy, Pete Wilhelm, who worked on the very first spy satellite in 1959, built all four Timation satellites for my dad and retired in 2014 after working a mere 55 years at NRL. So getting some new details about the history of GPS and some additional details are going to come out soon. So it's like peeling back an onion. There's always another layer underneath.
Absolutely. Anything else on your mind?
Nope, I think that's it.
Okay.
Great show.
Thanks for letting us know.
Bye-bye. Okay. All right, bye.
While we're waiting for another call, I want to make a clarifying or a fairly straightforward statement here. Simply put, the Space Show is not a radio program for conspiracy theories. I don't want conspiracy theorists and promoters on the show. I get emails maybe 3 or 4 a week from people who have this or that conspiracy theory. And I turn 100% of them down. And I usually never talk about them on open lines or tell you about them or anything like that. I'm not a conspiracy theory believer. And this is not a home for that kind of show. There are plenty of good formats if you want to talk conspiracy theory. And, you know, sometimes I listen to those shows. They're fun. And sometimes, you know, if there's some good data, they can even be thought-provoking. It's just this not going to happen on the Space Show. So this is much, much broader and much bigger than Richard Hoagland. This is not targeting toward Richard Hoagland. It's just in general, the Space Show is supposed to be an educational program. A lot of fact and a lot of visionary, a lot of ideas. You know the format. But we don't do conspiracy theories. And we also don't do name-calling. And, you know, those of you who have been listening the last couple of weeks, notice that we did get some emails from a guy in the Netherlands who did extensively do name calling in his emails, and some really derogatory terms. And I deleted his post on the blog, and I warned him privately, and he continued to do it, and I blocked him from, posting on the website, posting on the blog. So this is not a home for people who want to do name-calling, who want to tout this and that conspiracy theory. And again, some of them are a lot of fun, and some of them may even have facts to support them. I'm not arguing that. This is just not a home for it. And I don't want to do that. And the other thing is, it's not a home for NASA bashing. So I still get information from people, emails from people claiming we could do this, this, and the other if it weren't for NASA screwing everything up and being in the way and this, that, and the other. And it's a total, and they want to come on the program and talk about why NASA's a 5-million-ton elephant in the room. And I don't do that. I'm not in the interest of NASA bashing. Now, as you know, a lot of guests and a lot of callers disagree with NASA funding and programming and policies. And that's fine. But, you know, they're not NASA bashing. They're just disagreeing. And so disagreeing is fine, but we don't do bashing of anyone, including NASA, on the Space Show. So I just want to clarify this all based upon David's call. I'm not focusing on Mr. Hoagland here. I do consider him a friend. But the areas of his professionalism and his expertise are beyond the scope of what the Space Show wants to address. And there are plenty of really good formats for Richard and other people. And I believe Richard still has his evening radio show. I don't know that for a fact. But he's got great formats, and the Space Show is just not suited for those discussion topics. So I hope everyone understands that, because I'm not really directing anything against Richard at all. Listeners, the line is available if anybody wants to give us a call. It is 1-866-687-7223. And there is time on the call. I mean, time on the show if you do want to call us. I got an email from Doug. Thanks for keeping the show from jumping off the deep end. Well, that's from Doug. That's really concise. Doug is the only person I know who's wordier and more long-winded than me, and that says something. I'm always telling Doug to be succinct. But, boy, this time you nailed it, Doug. Thank you. Concise, succinct, and to the point. Going down the conspiracy road and some of this other stuff is just jumping off the deep end, and I'm not interested in doing that. I kind of get close to that with John Hunt. But as in today, I pulled it back, even though I really think there's something with the Defense Department and something with these sensors going on with this, these high-tech kind of aerial movements of whatever it is that's out there. I would like to know more about it, and I'm not jumping off the deep end that this stuff is coming in from outer space or from the center of the Earth or from, you know, the Marianas Trench. But I think something is going on with this technology, and the sensors are really accurate and reliable, and they're tracking it. And I don't know how to get more information about it. So I guess it just sits there. We do have another caller, and thank you, Doug, for very plainly and clearly stating that I don't want the show to go off the deep end. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you, and where are you, please?
Hi, it's Kyle in Duluth.
Okay, Carl is your name?
Kyle.
Kyle, okay. Thank you for calling, Kyle, and I hope it's not too cold in Duluth. Is it warming up?
Oh, yeah. The snow is almost all gone.
Ah, good for you, or good for the Duluth area. What's on your mind today?
Well, I've been kind of looking at your past shows, and I was wondering if you ever did any interviews about orbital rings or mass drivers, deep kind of future launch capabilities.
So probably not in the way that you're talking about. Orbital rings and mass drivers have come up in many different space show topics. I'm not sure we could search for those shows using those keywords. I don't know that we would, but I don't think they've come up in the context of what you're talking about. But if you have a guest or two in mind who is factual and not, you know, totally into fantasy and Kool-Aid, I'd be happy to invite them to the show.
Yeah, I just think, rockets are cool, but I don't know if they... It really depends on how the future goes, but there certainly are some boundaries that they can't do. You know, they can't. There's a limited cost that they can go down to before they start becoming not as effective as one of these could possibly be in theoretical terms, I guess.
Do you have a guest in mind or someone I could contact about this?
I don't. I guess I've been trying to find more sources on it, so that's why I was just curious if you had anybody on.
No, but let me give you a hint. Let me see if I can find... Here's my schedule coming up. So I have a guy from NASA who's also a science fiction writer and a deep thinker and certainly a future guy. His name is Dr. Jeff Landis. He's a very popular guy. He's come up with a theory for cloud cities in the Venetian atmosphere. He's really cool. And Jeff has been on the show many, many times, and he is returning to the show on Monday, April 9th. And Jeff is far out there, but he is at NASA. He is a real engineer, a real scientist, a very cool guy. So, number one, if you're able to listen Monday, April 9th from 2 p.m. to 3:30 California time, you could call and ask Jeff these questions because he would probably have information or at least be able to comment intelligently, which I'm not able to do. Or if you're unable to call him live, if you email questions for Dr. Landis before April 9th so that I have them, I will read your email questions to him on the show. And I think that might be a good bet for you to get some decent information on what you're talking about.
Okay, definitely we'll do that.
And you ought to look up Jeff Landis before you compose an email or call so you know who it is. So Jeffrey is really Jeffrey, G-E-O-F-F-R-E-Y, and Landis, L-A-N-D as in David, I-S. He is a doctor, Ph.D., And again, he's at NASA. He's a very famous science fiction writer, as well as engineer scientist, and really cool guy. I mean, the best. And I'd go to him with your questions if he wasn't coming on the show. But again, this is Monday, April 9th.
All right. Will do. I guess I just have one more kind of offhand mention about the space-based solar power thing.
Okay.
I guess there's a lot of research currently going into increasing efficiency of solar panels on Earth, but there's different, the atmosphere cancels out certain wavelengths, and I guess that's something to consider when you're talking about solar panels in orbit, that you want to tailor them for the wavelengths of the sun rather than for the wavelengths that are canceled out by the atmosphere on Earth. I guess I'm not much of a solar panel expert, but I guess there's different styles, and I guess what I'm saying is most of the research is being done for Earth-based solar rather than space-based solar. So
yeah, because the business case for space-based solar is just elusive as hell. I know the people who advocate it and like it kind of dismiss the business case, or you know, they have qualifications for it, or this or that or the other. But it's just not there. That does not mean that it might not be there. I mean, and it is effective for space-to-space needs, like the space station and some of these missions that are, you know, planetary missions. But if you're talking about delivering the power for a lunar colony or a Mars colony or something, it's going to require a lot more. And I think these kilopower nuclear reactors that are really tiny but can produce nuclear power in small amounts that NASA is working on really could change the energy requirements and supplies and stuff for space as well as here on Earth. And as I said, I'm trying to get the lead guy from NASA who wrote the paper. It was just published a couple of weeks ago. I'm going to follow it up this week to see if he's heard from PR department, NASA PA. I think that is really promising and probably would be a preferential way to go over solar power until somebody can make a business case for solar power.
Yeah, I absolutely agree there. The only other issue I can foresee with the nuclear power is at least in actual space rather than, say, on the moon or on Mars, is you have to deal with the waste heat generated. But just kind of a secondary issue. So
something to ask the kilopower guy if he comes on the show. By the way, listener Kim in Mexico sent in a blog comment applicable to your earlier comments and said for advanced propulsion, Kyle, tune into the Jeff Landis show and ask him. So she was supporting what I suggested about that Monday, April 9th program with Jeff.
All right.
Thank you for your call.
I absolutely do that.
Call us
Have
again.
A good day.
Appreciate hearing from you. Bye-bye. So the line is available. I have another note from Terry. So Terry says New Horizons is due for the next flyby January 1st. On January 1st, it would be interesting to get a current update. And what is it going to fly by? I'm looking for my show schedule. Okay, here it is. So, Terry, you will be happy to know that Alan Stern is coming back on the show Sunday, April 15th. Tax day! Actually, tax day is April 16th because the 15th is on a weekend where the mail doesn't work, although the mail doesn't work most days, but that's neither here nor there. So Alan is with us again. He wrote a new book on the cosmos with David Grinspoon, the two are co-authors. And Alan is coming on to talk about the book on April 15th and has promised us New Horizons and other updates. So you want to tune in on Sunday, April 15th, okay? Very, very cool. Thank you, Terry, for your email. We do have another caller who is on hold. I got another email. Doug, Kilopower question. do you or any of your listeners know if kilopower is at the level of propellant production? I assume not, but would like to know if anyone knows. No, it's still pretty theoretical from what I could tell from reading the paper on it. So, you know, the guy who knows more about this than me and who always writes in to talk about it is Tim in Huntsville, and he's the one who introduced the subject to me. And if I can remember, Doug, I will put the name of the paper and the link in the archive summaries of today's show, Kilopower Paper Archive Summary. So, and y'all can read it, and then you'll know about as much about it as I do. So I just made a note to put that into the summary when I archived today's show. I can't remember the title of it or the person's name. Let me go to the phone lines again. Good afternoon, caller. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hi there. This is Rick in Silicon Valley or Fremont or whoever I am.
What? You don't even know where you are anymore, right?
Well, I answer one or the other sometimes. So anyway, I thought people don't realize that Fremont is on the north end of Silicon Valley. Depending
no.
on how far you think the valley goes.
Well, yeah. I just know of Fremont being over on the East Bay side, but further south.
It's on kind of the southeast part, and I'd say some of the a lot of at least a couple of decades ago, a lot of the Silicon Valley companies that were doing manufacturing of chips, when there wasn't any more land in the Core Valley itself, they started moving up to Fremont, and I think that's about as far as they went. It was like the last vestige of open land for Silicon Valley.
Well, it's we haven't heard from you in a long time. So how have you been, and why have you not been calling us? You need some discipline here.
Yeah, I know. It's there's always too much going on with me. Now I've been listening. Well, on podcasts, I keep listening to all the shows.
Yeah, it's not the same as having you as a live caller.
Yeah, I know. It's what can I say? Too many things happening during the day. Anyway, so I guess I was listening to Marshall's comments, and so this is a bit of encouragement. I like where he's going with it, and you know, I've talked to the Made in Space people before, and you know, they're I think they have their sights in the right place, things like that. I think so. My understanding of what Marshall was talking about in terms of bulk material, I think he was talking about putting up solar panels which had already been manufactured on Earth, but laying them flat, you know, and then anyway, transporting them up into orbit in that fashion and then having them assembled there, which means that you don't have to have a big flimsy structure that needs to be fully articulated and things like that before you put it up, which I think is a good idea, except for one problem, telerobotics. You need some sort of robotic mechanism to assemble all that in orbit, and I don't know who's got that yet or when they'll have it, or, you know, is anyone even working? I mean, I guess there are some basic notions of how to do robotics in space, out in the vacuum of space, but this is like, before we can actually do manufacturing in space, this is like another challenge that needs to be, you know, that needs to be taken care of. I mean, the robot is going to be, there's the vacuum, you know, you try to lubricate things, that the lubrication doesn't work in space. Depending on whether you're looking at the sun or you're shielded from the sun, you know, the temperature, there's great temperature swings. I also don't know, where are you going to get a power source for this, you know, if the robot, I assume the robot is going to have to do things like press things into place, screw things into place, and things like that. And that's taking energy. And I don't know where that energy is coming from. So this is like a catch-22. Before you can get the power up there, you know, before you can get the big structures, you need a robotic system. To get the robotic system, you need a power source. Where are you going to get the power source from? And I haven't figured my way around that. But that's kind of where I think some of those big issues are.
So Made in Space is getting ready to experiment with a 3D printer in free space.
Yeah, for doing fiber.
For doing fiber, yeah. Which is
a great idea.
Which is the first kind of step. But I don't believe that this has happened yet. But this is really a precursor to anything Marshall's talking about.
And, exactly.
And this is a big deal. And I'm going to be following up with Maiden Space and my contacts there. And I'm really excited about this.
Yeah, it is a big deal. I like the fact that they can do fiber, which apparently has better optical qualities than fiber made on Earth, or at least that's the hope. You know, we'll see what the quality actually comes out to be. But, and that has great, apparently has great economic benefit on Earth. Actually, I wasn't thinking about this when I called, but come to think of it, I had this interesting conversation a couple of weeks ago with some people from CASIS, right, Center for Advancement of Science and Space, and they were talking about, they want to make space more relevant to, you know, commercial applications on Earth, things of that sort. And we were talking, as a matter of fact, about a space, you know, manufacturing in space, how pharmaceuticals could be done in space and things like that. And I said to them, yeah, I think it's a great idea. There's only one problem, which is down mass. If you do all this manufacturing in space, and let's say you make drugs of some sort in space, things like that, how do you get them down to the Earth? You know, right now there's like, as so far as I can tell, there's like basically two ways to get things down from the space station. One of them is, using the Dragon capsule. When that thing re-enters the Earth, sometimes you can put things in there, but there's probably a limited space there. And, excuse me, the other thing that I knew of was when the astronauts come back in the Soyuz capsule, apparently they can put some small containers at the feet of those astronauts. And none of this sounds to me like a good way to get, you know, quantities of stuff down from space for manufacturing. So that's another problem that needs to be. If you're going to use it on the Earth, you need to find a better way to get things down. That's the other problem.
Absolutely.
And I kind of did some blue sky thinking about how would you do those types of things. Cause, I know a person at NASA Ames who has been working on that concept with students at San Jose State for a while. I don't particularly like it. I mean, it's a good first step. I think what he had in mind was just bringing down small, like, experiments, things of that sort. You run some sort of experiment on the space station. You don't have enough equipment to analyze the result, but you'd like to bring it back in a timely fashion. So, like, if you have a biological specimen, you want to somehow eject that out of the station, have it come down to Earth, and be, you know, within hours or something like that, be able to analyze that specimen. Now, the other problem with coming down by way of capsule, at least as I recall from the Soyuz capsule, I think the maximum G is something like, I think they've had something like 8 Gs coming down. And the thing is, if you've got biological specimens, things like that, you pretty much want to limit yourself to something like 3.5 Gs. So we used to have that with things like the space shuttle. It's like, in order to do this kind of general reentry, you almost have to have wings, or you have to have a really big parachute or something like that. And parasail, airfoil, something like that, before, you know, to slow you down in a more gentle fashion. Otherwise, your G-forces are going to crush your sample, and you're not going to have valid results. That's my understanding of things.
Yeah, my understanding, too. Without the shuttle, it was a real handicap to bring stuff back.
Yeah.
Because
it
needs a real gentle G-force to enter.
Right. I mean, people don't realize that. I mean, I've heard a lot of people say that the shuttle was it costs a lot. That's true. We could have done things a better way. But I've had some friends who ought to know better say that capsules, because they're a simpler system, are a much better way to go. But I don't think they were thinking about, you know, the recovery of biological material, which has been something that's always kind of bugged me.
Yeah, no. And so that is a big deal, and I'm not even sure that it can come back okay on a Soyuz.
Yeah. I have serious doubts about that.
That is a big issue. So we'll see how the new space capsules return and if that opens that market up again.
Yeah, so there's my 2 cents on the hurdles to commercialization and manufacturing. So one of them being you need a more gentle reentry somehow and get it out on demand. And the other thing is, how in the world do you manufacture things when you don't have enough power? That's my 2 stumbling blocks.
All right. Good to hear from you. Don't be a stranger.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
I think that's all I got.
All right. Thanks, Rick. Bye-bye.
Okay. All right.
Listener Rick Kwan is off the phone, and we are always glad to hear from him. The phone number, and we still have a few more minutes, although we're past the two-hour mark right now, is 1-866-687-7223. I have a question out there for anyone. Have any of you guys, is anyone out there other than me, ever sent their loved one's ashes or used a Celestis for a flight? I'm curious. I have no reason for really asking it, but if anybody out there has used Celestis, why don't you tell us about your experience? And maybe not today, but on another open line show, or you could do it by email or a blog post or something like that. Not sure we'll get any more phone calls because it is past the two-hour point, but again, I'm getting ready to shut us down. 1-866-687-7223. We are coming up on the bewitching moment. I did mention shows for this week. So Mark Raymond on the Dawn is Monday. Kim Holder on Moonwords, and check out her videos on the blog before the show. Hotel Mars is unknown for right now. Dr. Drago's Bratsasana, I think he's in Romania, is back on with us. He's been doing some work on space entrepreneurism. There's no show on Easter Sunday. Next Monday, a week from tomorrow, is Dr. Joshua Banfield, and he is the person who wrote an interesting paper, a peer-reviewed paper on the distribution of water on the moon. The Queensland University guy, Dr. Adam Dodd, is with us next Tuesday, a week from this Tuesday. Ben Pearson, thank you, Kim, for the introduction of the Space Stock Stack Exchange is on. I hope I got that right. If Kim is listening, she can correct me. Sunday, April 8th, Project Possum has been doing some interesting things, and Jason Reimuller is back with us, and then Jeff Landis, and then Casey Dreyer, the Planetary Society. Dr. Dirk Schultz-Makuch, who is in Germany, wrote a great book. You'll really enjoy what he has to say. The book is called The Cosmic Zoo. Alan Stern on April 15th. Dr. Kirsten Halley is going to talk more about the HAMR project for averting an asteroid impact. And she's from Lawrence Livermore Lab. We'll see how far we can go with Dr. Halley regarding nuclear thermal blast isotopes and things of that nature. Seth Shostak of SETI back on April 17th. Jose Ocasio-Christian back with us on Friday the 20th. Open Lines is on Sunday the 22nd. James Schwartz of Wichita State is going to be back with us on the 23rd to continue his series of discussions with us on the myth of the frontier. Space journalist Tom Risen is going to give us a report on the Space Foundation and some of the articles he's written for the AIAA Journal. Orbital ATK on the 27th. The 29th is Brian Keating, and he wrote a really great book called Losing the Nobel Prize, and he's a cosmologist at UC San Diego. And then former astronaut and former previous space show guest of many times, Dr. Tom Jones returns. We're going to talk astronaut safety and other topics. So it looks like the phone line has dried up, so we can wish everybody a very pleasant rest of the weekend. and a great week coming up. So thank those of you who called, those of you who emailed. We appreciate it. And everybody, keep it safe. And as Sunday shuts down and the new week opens up, keep looking up. And goodbye from all of the callers, all of the emailers, and myself. And we thank you for participating in today's Open Lines program. Again, everybody, goodbye from the Space Show.